Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 20th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland ISD faces fiscal cliff concerns. Texas legislature's disagreement regarding school funding bill, a cause for worry. By Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The Texas legislature has not yet come up with a school funding bill agreeable to both the House and the Senate. And because of that disagreement, there is still the possibility of a fiscal cliff for Midland ISD. The fiscal cliff is a possibility because since 2019, Midland ISD has received tens of millions of dollars in, quote, formula transition grant, unquote, funding to ensure that all districts would receive at least a 3% increase in per-student funding. Midland ISD told the Reporter-Telegram that grant funding was expected to be around $45 million for the 2023-24 school year. The Texas School Coalition reports that formula transition grant funding is set to expire after the 2023-24 school year, and that more than 200 districts would be impacted. But Midland ISD would be impacted more than any other. In fact, the Texas School Coalition reported that during the 2022-23 school year, formula transition grant funding for Midland ISD was $53.344 million. The next closest districts were Houston ISD, $39.571 million, and Carrollton Farmers Branch ISD, $23.173 million. State Representative Tom Craddock has provided amendments during sessions this year to extend transition grant formula funding through the 2029-30 school year. Because the House and Senate can't agree on education funding, the Craddock amendment to help Midland ISD with its transition formula grant issue remains in limbo. The legislature adjourned without setting a date or time to reconvene, and there were no school finance or education provisions that made their way into law, Midland ISD reported. Unless there is a fifth special legislative session addressing school finance, the formula transition grant will expire. In light of the expiration of the formula transition grant in Texas public schools, the community should be aware, but Midland Independent School District has been planning for this since 2019 to mitigate concerns related to the loss of funding. Midland ISD has built up its fund balance of around $200 million over the past few years in preparation for the fiscal cliff, which was first talked about publicly around 2021. Should the legislature not have a solution, it would likely require cuts or force the district to consider a tax ratification election to increase revenue in the maintenance and operations budget. The district is diligently reviewing all programs and activities and working on budget preparation for the upcoming fiscal year, demonstrating a proactive approach to addressing the funding loss, MISD reported. There is a sufficient amount of fund balance earmarked directly related to addressing the funding loss from the FTG expiration. While the expected expiration of the formula transition grant will result in funding loss, the district aims to reassure the community of our proactive planning, financial preparedness, and transparent communication. This article is entitled Back in Compliance. After months of back and forth with the city, the tailgate is finally up to code. However, the venue plans to move in 2025. By Morgan Taylor Thomas, staff writer. After a dramatic couple of months between the City of Midland and the tailgate, the venue was finally approved and deemed in compliance with city code at the December 12th council meeting. Now, the team at the tailgate commented on what exactly happened leading up to co-owner Sean Elphick's ticketing plea from November 14th's council meeting. The misconception was, why didn't the tailgate just pay for these codes to be in compliance? But there were a lot of moving parts that had to happen in order for us to be back in compliance, co-owner Ariel Herrera stated. Originally, the tailgate was supposed to be only a food truck park. But after seeing the popularity of the concerts downtown, Herrera said she and her fellow co-owners realized they could do so much more. Small band showcases quickly became full-on sets with lighting, speakers, and agents. The venue's large stage area was built, upgrades were made, and the space transformed within a matter of months. However, the exponential growth wasn't the only problem. The land where the tailgate sits is owned by HEB, meaning Herrera simply rents the corner spot, southwest of the intersection at Big Spring Street and Loop 250. We actually went and met with HEB in San Antonio at their headquarters, so they were fully aware of what we were doing. It was just hard for the city to figure out how to categorize us because we don't own the land. Technically, we're not a permanent structure, but we're operating as such. That's where the confusion came into play, Herrera explained. For us, we knew it was a proven concept, and we wanted to keep having these big concerts. So we asked, how do we get in compliance? Bathrooms, a fire lane, and turn signal requirement proved to be no problem for the tailgate. The parking lot, however, was a different story. Since the business does not own the land, HEB ultimately has final say, Herrera said. Knowing that HEB would eventually be tearing the parking lot up caused Herrera to question whether the $500,000 plus renovation was financially the right move. The solution? A new location. We placed an official offer on land and basically have plans to move so that we can build something even bigger with more amenities, occupancy, and correct parking, Herrera said. We have our lease with HEB until 2025, so we're going to plan on operating as we have been, with additions that the city has required, and then opening our new location at that time. Although the tailgate plans to keep the exact location a secret for now, Herrera said it will be on Loop 250, but near Astound Broadband Stadium. The tailgate is currently closed for the winter season, with the exception of a few sports watch parties here and there. All updates will be posted to their social media pages. This article is entitled County Leaders Hear City's Presentation on Downtown TERS by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. Gabriel McClelland, Director of Engineering Services for the City of Midland, gave a presentation on a tax increment reinvestment zone at Midland County Commissioners Court meeting Tuesday. County commissioners said the types of downtown improvements that the TERS will make possible are well overdue. This version of the TERS was presented to the City Council in October. A tax increment reinvestment zone is the real property where tax collected is set aside to fund projects. The zone will be created initially for the city tax increments, although other entities are being asked to participate. The tax increment is the amount of ad valorem tax assessed or collected above the cap set from the property within the zone. McClellan outlined the planned downtown improvements for county commissioners. Initially, here are the points of emphasis. Alley revitalization. Specifically, alleys adjacent to the DoubleTree by Hilton, Midland Plaza, and Basin PBS. Downtown lighting projects. Tree, signs, and string lighting at Colorado and Wall Street, Wall and Main Street. Streetscape enhancements. Cyclist, pedestrian improvements, landscape improvements, parklets, public art, and street furniture. Parking. On street, better uses of public garages, incorporate up to 1,800 privately owned surface lots, like those by the downtown library, and improving parking lighting and signage. Wayfinding signs. Creating paths to landmarks, identify paths to downtown parking, and identify various districts. The city also reported that there is $400,000 left over from a TERS that was in place in Midland from 2001 until 2014. Precinct 2 Commissioner Jeff Summers asked McClellan about a time frame when Midlanders can expect to see these downtown improvements come to fruition. McClellan said lighting projects will most likely come first, and that the city is in a design phase for the lighting projects currently, according to McClellan. While the city representative did not give an exact schedule or time frame, he implied completion of some downtown projects before the end of 2024. You're talking more along the line of months before I think we can see something, McClellan said. County commissioners expressed their support and excitement for the downtown projects. Summers said he was looking forward to the downtown improvements and couldn't wait until they are completed. County Judge Terry Johnson thanked the city for the work they have done on the project and said these kinds of improvements in downtown Midland are long overdue. On Tuesday, the commissioners just heard a presentation on the TERS. This was not a voting item. This column is called Opinion. It is entitled, How Should Midlanders Rank Public High Schools? By Patricia Maurer, guest columnist. On a rare occasion, when I chose to disagree with my father, he asked, Is that the hill you've chosen to die on? My father was open to lively debate with his adult children, but if you indicated a readiness to state your case, you better be ready to defend it. This exchange came to mind reading a Midland Reporter Telegram article naming the U.S. News and World Report's ranking of the best high schools in America. As a hill, we as a community should climb. A primary factor in considering the quality of local public high schools. Consequently, I researched the issue. You cannot argue with the methodology employed to calculate U.S. News and World Report rankings. Whether rankings as calculated represent the hill we want to die on remains an open question. It's not so much what they use to judge one school as better than another, it's what they leave out. Ranking reflects questions researchers chose to ask. Factors used are straightforward, 6 categories of information, each based on performance indicators. College readiness, 30%. College curriculum breadth, 10%, state assessment proficiency, 20%, state assessment performance, 20%, underserved student population, 10%, and graduation rate, 10%. For light reading, find a detailed explanation at usnews.com/education/best-high-schools/articles/how-us-news-calculated-the-rankings. While straightforward, these rankings have limitations. College readiness and college curriculum breadth, 40% of the weight, derive solely from participation and performance on advanced placement exams, AP, or International Baccalaureate Exams, IB. Because these scores count heavily in the protocol, a school will never climb the rankings without climbing the AP or IB hill. If that's what the Midland community needs to call our public high schools excellent, we can tackle the challenge. However, putting all your eggs in the AP or IB basket does not represent the only way a public high school can demonstrate college readiness and college curriculum breadth. More importantly, AP and IB scores are not all that define an excellent public high school. Consider these facts. It costs $98 to take an AP exam. Through a series of federal and state subsidies, costs to low-income students reduced to $9. However, the College Board gets all of its money. College Board AP exams are big business, yielding high revenue that does not benefit local education or public education in Texas. Whether AP courses deliver the promise of college readiness and college curriculum breadth remains debatable. According to the College Board, 1,166,311 students in the class of 2022, 34.6% of U.S. public high school graduates, took at least one AP exam. And 729,673 students in the class of 2022, 21.6% of U.S. public high school graduates, scored a 3 or higher on at least one AP exam. The number of students taking AP exams is definitely on the rise. Progress? Maybe, maybe not. U.S. News and World Report considers scores of 3, 4, and 5 for awarding points for college readiness. However, a score of 5 is required to exempt students from retaking and repaying for a course at many universities. According to my calculations, 436,638 students in the class of 2022 made a 1 or 2 on an exam, earning no college credit, but generating $42,790,524 of free revenue for the College Board. Are lower costs for AP tests really good news for low-income students? In an article on the front page of the New York Times, November 19th, College Board pushes its test many will fail, you find this. Left out of the narrative is one of the most sobering statistics in education. Some 60% of AP exams taken by low-income students this year scored too low for college credit, 1 or 2 out of 5, a statistic that has not budged in 20 years. Many years ago, MISD chose to do two things. In order to create greater access to the AP experience, MISD chose an open enrollment approach for AP courses. MISD, like many school districts, bought into the notion that AP courses were the best way to provide more students with a college preparatory experience in a public school setting, a strategy the College Board was happy to champion. Second, in what might be called a smarter move for Midland students, MISD began to build and to promote concurrent courses with Midland College. College courses students take while in high school. College credit earned for A's or B's in a concurrent course at MC transfers to public colleges and universities in Texas. I don't oppose the U.S. News & World Report ranking system for naming the best public high schools in America. It does not, however, give credit to schools for a concurrent enrollment option, another valid way to demonstrate college readiness and college curriculum breadth. The program has blossomed in MISD, and some courses in the MISD catalog offer both concurrent enrollment and potential AP credit. Concurrent enrollment represents an appealing local investment, what might be termed a triple threat. It allows students to build college readiness skills on the job. It allows students to save money and to accrue credit for basic courses before applying to a four-year university. It creates a pipeline to public colleges and universities in Texas, some of the best values in higher education. Concurrent enrollment at Midland College is a win-win, both for MISD students and for MC. It represents a hill worth climbing, a local initiative worthy of attention, expansion, and an infusion of money where needed. This article is entitled, Kinsey Appointed Chair of State Board of Education, by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. Aaron Kinsey, Midlander and State Board of Education District 15 representative, was appointed to serve as chair of the Texas State Board of Education by Governor Greg Abbott on Monday, according to a press release. The governor selects one SBOE member to chair the board. Kinsey's term is set to expire on December 17, 2025. Kinsey will succeed District 9's Kevin Ellis, who was appointed to the position in 2019, the press release states. Aaron Kinsey's previous service in the Air Force and depth of experience as a business leader will be a boon to the SBOE as he assumes this important role. Working together with Aaron and the SBOE, Texas will continue to prepare our students to reach greater heights in the Texas of tomorrow, Abbott wrote. The excerpt describing Kinsey's accomplishments in the press release reads, Aaron Kinsey of Midland is the SBOE District 15 representative. He is CEO of American Patrols, Inc., an aviation oilfield services company. He served in the U.S. Air Force from 2005 to 2014. During his 9 years of service, he was a pilot, flying 120 combat missions in a C-130 and taught pilot training and instructor pilot courses. He is a member of the Texas Permanent School Fund Corporation Committee on School Finance Permanent School Fund and chair of the Committee on Strategic Planning and Policy, which manages $55 billion in investments for the benefit of Texas education. Additionally, he is a member of the Texas Public Policy Foundation Liberty Leadership Council, former member of the Adam Smith Society Host Committee, and former community group leader for Redeemer Midland Church. Kinsey received a Bachelor of Business Administration in Accounting and a Master of Science in Finance from Texas A&M University and a Master of Business Administration from Harvard Business School. This article is entitled, Late Night Fire Rips Through Historic Petroleum Building, by B.K. Richter, staff writer. First responders, the Midland Police Department and the Midland Fire Department, were called to a fire located inside the historic petroleum building in downtown Midland during the evening hours on Monday. According to reports, the fire was on the 9th floor of the building. The building's owner, David Arrington, said that there were no injuries reported during the incident. The concrete construction contained it to a 10x10 office, he wrote in an email message to the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Chase Cochran, a multimedia communications specialist with the City of Midland, also confirmed that first responders were at the scene of the incident. At approximately 10:30 p.m., crews from the Midland Fire Department and Midland Police Department responded to a fire at the 200 block of Texas Avenue, he wrote in a press statement. Crews arrived on scene of a high-rise office building with smoke and fire venting out of the ninth-floor window. Responders confirmed that there was no extension to other floors of the building or adjacent offices. The building was empty at the time. The petroleum building was designed by the Fort Worth architect Wyatt C. Hendrick and completed in 1929. The building has long played a significant role in the history of Midland, as well as casting a significant role in the development of the city. T.S. Hogan, a Montana attorney, rancher, and oilman, came to the Permian Basin in 1925 and became active in the oil business. In 1927, Hogan announced the construction of the petroleum building. This article is entitled, Oil Hits Two-Week High as Red Sea Attacks Stoke Shipping Fears, by Julia Fanzeres and Mia Gindis, Bloomberg. Oil rose to the highest price in more than 2 weeks, as companies increasingly steer clear of the Red Sea, amid a spike in vessel attacks along the key shipping conduit. West Texas Intermediate's more active February contract advanced 1.5% to settle near $74 a barrel after BP PLC and Equinor ASA said they would pause all shipments through the waterway. The recent escalation in attacks by Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen has bolstered a rebound in oil prices that had slumped to a 5-month low last week amid signs of rising production. Despite the current rally, some traders don't anticipate long-term price impacts for crude, and time spreads, a critical barometer for supply and demand, continue to indicate weakness. WTI's prompt spread, the difference between its January and February contracts, settled at 50 cents in contango, signaling an abundance of barrels available in the near term. The longer-term impact on oil prices of Houthis' attacks on oil tankers through the Red Sea is a complicated one, said Fawad Razakzadeh, a market analyst at City Index and Forex.com. While the oil price gains are justified, it's very difficult to say how long the gains will last for, or how much higher will prices go from here on, just on the back of this factor alone. The most tangible disruption to energy flows since the Israel-Hamas war led the U.S. to announce a new maritime task force to protect commercial vessels. About 8% of the world's crude transits through the Suez Canal, putting pressure on tanker utilization if ships are forced to take the longer route around South Africa, Jefferies analysts said in a note. Disruption to major trading conduits tend to be short-term, and it's likely the U.S. will take firmer military actions to counter these tensions, said John Driscoll, director and founder of Singapore-based consultant JT Energy Services, PTE Limited. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Private Shale Drillers Set to Cut Spending, by David Weth, Bloomberg. Closely held explorers, once the engine to Permian's shale growth coming out of the pandemic, are now expected to lead U.S. oil explorers into spending contraction next year. Private oil and natural gas explorers are projected to cut their budgets by 4% to an average of $34.4 billion in 2024, according to the 39th Annual Global Spending Survey from Barclays PLC. The contraction, the biggest forecast among North American companies, comes after the private drillers increased expenditures by 15% this year. After better than expected output in 2023, the U.S. shale patch is now in the midst of slowing down amid dwindling inventory for top-tier drilling locations. Total North American producer spending is forecast to drop 1% next year, after budgets expanded more than expected this year. Barclays analysts, including J. David Anderson, wrote Tuesday in a note to investors. The Barclays estimate follows an Evercore ISI spending survey earlier this month that forecast a 2% budget bump from U.S. oil producers next year, as crude production likely increases by just 150,000 barrels a day in 2024, a fraction of this year's 1 million barrel per day growth. This year's surprising jump in U.S. oil production is partly attributable to expansion among private producers, who Barclays says account for roughly half of the U.S. drilling rigs and as much as 40% of the country's onshore production. This column is called Small Bites. It is entitled, Rorschach Coffee Was Birthed Out of Necessity. Downtown Midland Cafe offers specialty drinks, real fruit tea. By Morgan Taylor Thomas, staff writer. Seth Stroon is no stranger to the demand of downtown. The former Low Street Books owner and current micro market man plays a prominent role in the hustle and bustle of Wall Street's entertainment district. His latest adventure, Rorschach Coffee, takes the tiny rectangular spot where Corporal Ray's used to reside. Inside the cornflower blue painted spot, Stroon serves up cold and hot drinks for Midlanders walking by. Rorschach was birthed out of necessity, but we thought about opening a coffee shop for a long time. Honestly, since we started Micro Market, Stroon explained. We haven't been advertising a whole lot, just seeing what the foot traffic is. And it's been really good. Rorschach uses Lone Star Coffee, roasted in Toller, near Fort Worth, by Whiskey Morning Coffee. The business specializes in bourbon, barrel-aged coffee, and smoked coffee, both served at Rorschach. We're doing everything in-house. We make all of our own syrups, vanilla bean and hazelnut. We're going to do some food items starting in the new year, but this was our chance to get in here and do a quick soft open, reset, and then back to normal, Stroon stated. As of now, Rorschach offers four coffees, a cold brew, one latte, and a ginger tea. Foods in the new year will include breakfast tacos and pastries. The Psycho Latte. This is our specialty drink. It's similar to a Vietnamese iced coffee, so it has some sweetened condensed milk, our house-made hazelnut syrup, and our cold brew. Hot ginger tea. It's literally ginger, lemon, and sugar. It doesn't have any tea leaf or anything like that. We're wanting to specialize in real fruit teas, so we're going to have different teas pop up seasonally. Brainchild. Coffee and shrooms. It has cordyceps and lion's mane mushroom, which are proven to help with focus. I experienced life with ADHD, and I've seen the results in the 6 months I've been drinking it. You still get that classic coffee caffeine with a little additive. Barrel-aged coffee. The coffee is stored and aged in a bourbon barrel for 2 months, and then roasted to a medium roast. Texian Army Coffee. All of the coffees from Whiskey Morning are wood fire roasted, but this one they do a cold smoke finish on. It's got some really smoky notes. White Buffalo Coffee. This is our strongest drink because it's an espresso. It has some nutty flavors to it. It's funny, nobody feels like they have time to make coffee at home, so they'll sit in line, Struan joked. These big corporate companies that are building coffee places here, they've done their research. They're not just randomly throwing a coffee shop here or there. They're looking at the sales reports from other coffee shops in their area, and they see there's a huge spike. It's the rush. We're a busy city. For now, Rorschach is open from 7 to 11 a.m. Monday through Friday. Any special events happening downtown or at the park also will add hours to the business. This article is entitled, Texas to Revisit Power Reserve Policies After Watchdog's Concerns, by Rachel Adams Hurd, Bloomberg. Texas power regulators will participate in a review of methods used to obtain backup electricity supplies after an uncharacteristically sharp debate between the grid operator and its watchdog. The Texas Public Utility Commission will take part in a true reevaluation by the end of April of how the grid manager procures so-called ancillary services, PUC member Lori Kobos said in Austin on Tuesday. Her comments came 6 months after the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, launched its first new backup services program in more than two decades. That service, called the ERCOT Contingency Reserve Service, or ECRS, created artificial scarcity that drove up wholesale power prices, according to Potomac Economics, which serves as ERCOT's independent market monitor. After initially estimating the ECRS inflated prices by more than $8 billion in just 3 months, Potomac recently said that number had grown to more than $12 billion. ERCOT, which is overseen by the PUC, operates the main Lone Star State grid, serving more than 25 million people. ERCOT introduced ECRS as a new pool of reserves that can respond quickly to cover shortfalls, particularly when solar supply drops at sunset. In September, Bloomberg reported that on one particularly dramatic day, ECRS caused 2,000 megawatts of cheap, otherwise available power to sit on the sidelines, even as prices spiked. Days after Potomac presented its recent analysis, ERCOT published a post on its website saying cost estimates like those were, quote, absolutely false, unquote. The grid manager stressed that the majority of players in the wholesale market hedged their positions, insulating consumers from those costs. But Potomac clapped back, saying ERCOT's response was, quote, very disappointing, unquote, and that it never said it was quantifying the consumer cost. Potomac also pointed out that forward prices for next summer rose 67% after the ECRS was introduced. Therefore, consumers will see an increasing share of these market costs over time, as supply contracts expire and are renewed, Potomac said. We're very much concerned about costs to the market, whatever they may be, Kobos said. I just want to make sure we're taking a very concerted, deep look at what we're doing in April to get ready for the summer. This is the Life Tributes column. Kathy Gibson, July 10, 1954 to December 15, 2023. It is with profound sadness we announce the passing of Catherine Gibson, our loving and devoted mother, wife, and friend to all whose lives she touched. Kathy, 69, went to be with Jesus surrounded by her family at 4:09 p.m., December 15, 2023. Kathy was born to William Truman and Doretha Mae Brooks on July 10, 1954, in Pecos. Kathy is survived by her husband Gary of Midland, daughters Brandy, Daniel Price of Lubbock, Amy Gibson of Midland, sons Cody, Sherry Lehman of Midland, Blake Gibson of Midland, as well as 9 grandchildren and 1 great-grandson. She is preceded in death by her parents, W.T. and Dot Brooks, and her only brother, Stephen Brooks. Family and friends are invited to celebrate her life and legacy at Christ Church Anglican on December 21st at 11 a.m. We encourage everyone to wear bright colors and patterns to honor her personality and love for everything bright in this life. Donations in Kathy's honor can be made to Senior Life Midland Meals on Wheels program, changing lives for the elderly, disabled, and lonely in Midland County. Maria Luisa Jimenez, September 16, 1943, to December 17, 2023. Maria Luisa Jimenez, 80, a resident of Midland and beloved wife of the late Luis Jimenez, gained her wings December 17, 2023. Maria was born September 16, 1943, in Eola, Texas, to the late Truverlo and Antonia Salas. She was a great mother, grandma, great-grandma, sister, aunt, and friend. Maria was preceded in death by her husband, Luis Jimenez, and her parents, Truverlo and Antonia Salas, her brothers Victor Salas, Roy Salas, Cristobal Salas, Alfred Salas, and sisters Olivia Salea, Elia Castillo, Amelia Salas, Mary Garcia, Juanita Rivera, and Betty Gonzalez. Maria leaves behind her beloved children, daughters Noemi Avitia and Rosalinda Tamez, husband Jesus Tamez, sons Mario Jimenez, wife Dora, and Jesse Jimenez, wife Michelle, as well as 16 grandchildren and many great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, as well as her sisters Minnie Rios of Fort Stockton and Josephine Adako of Chicago. Viewing will be held from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday, December 21st at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Friday, December 22nd at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Belle Battle Reichley, August 8, 1958 to December 16, 2023. Austin. Belle Battle Reichley passed away peacefully on December 16th at her home in San Marcos at the age of 65, leaving behind family and friends grieving her sudden death. Belle grew up in Midland, where she attended Midland High School and subsequently Texas Tech University. Belle lived in Dallas, where she married the love of her life, Kevin Reichley, purchased their first home, and brought her beloved sons, Logan and Landon, into the world. The family moved to Austin in 1994. Belle Reichley was born in Big Spring on August 8, 1958, to John Hal Tiger Battle and Margaret Mon Jackson Battle. She is survived by her sons, Richard Logan Reichley, Landon Reed Reichley, daughter-in-law Carly Reichley, and 2 grandchildren, Sonny Drew and Jones Tiger. She was also blessed with her 2 sisters, Becky Brands and Jean O'Shaughnessy, and brother Bob Battle. She is also survived by countless beloved cousins, nieces, and nephews. Services will be held at Westlake Hills Presbyterian Church on Friday, December 22nd at 9:30 a.m. Address is 7127 Bee Cave Road in Austin. In lieu of flowers and considering Belle's love for dogs, the family asks that you consider a donation to Emancipet, 7201 Lavender Loop Buildings I and K in Austin, or online at www.emancipet.org. Thank you for your love and support. Juanita Avalos. Juanita Avalos, age 87, of Stanton, passed away December 19th. Visitation will be held Thursday, December 21st, from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be Friday, December 22nd, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Stanton. Burial to follow at St. Joseph's Catholic Cemetery. Online condolences can be received at www.stantonfh.com. Emma Ilya Ramirez. Emma Ilya Ramirez, 74, passed away on Monday, December 18th. Viewing will be Wednesday, December 20th, from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m., and Thursday, December 21st, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary beginning at 7 p.m. Thursday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Friday, December 22nd, at 10 a.m. at San Miguel Archangel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com.
Love and Light Donation. Deadly tornadoes in Clarksville, Tennessee, recently tore through that city. The city of Odessa will send a $100,000 donation to the city to help those affected by the tornado. The donation was given by ICA to the city of Odessa to give to Clarksville. When disasters strike across the country, ICA, owned by Odessa's John Bushman, has always been generous and quick to help other communities. The company wanted this donation to be from the Odessa community to the Clarksville community. The tornado was rated an EF3 with top winds at about 150 miles per hour and a 43-mile-long track. The Tennessean reported 6 people were killed in the tornadoes and dozens of others were injured. NWS said one was in Clarksville and another in the Gallatin area. The Tennessee Emergency Management Agency received reports of 13 possible tornadoes across that state. Local news roundup. Odessian accused of repeatedly ramming occupied Toyota. An Odessa man was arrested Friday after another man accused him of intentionally and repeatedly ramming his vehicle while it was occupied. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a shots fired call from the 2100 block of West 5th Street around 5:30 p.m., and when they arrived, they found a heavily damaged Toyota Camry and a heavily damaged GMC. The driver of the Toyota told officers he and his brother were waiting outside a residence in the car when Fernando Fernandez quickly reversed out of his driveway, put his vehicle in drive, and intentionally rammed the Toyota, the report stated. The Toyota driver said Fernandez did the same thing twice more and only stopped when he began shooting at Fernandez, the report stated. Officers found a bullet hole in the GMC's hood. Fernandez's mother corroborated the other driver's story, and officers found skid marks they believe were consistent with the story, too, the report stated. Fernandez was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and he remained in the Ector County Jail Monday night on a $25,000 surety bond. Relative named suspect in golf club attack. A 44-year-old man was taken to a Lubbock hospital with life-threatening head injuries Saturday after a relative allegedly struck him with a golf club. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a medical call from the 900 block of Prairie Avenue around 4:30 p.m., and when they arrived, they found a man in the front yard whose head had been caved in from blunt force trauma, and he was rushed to the hospital. Officers also found John Anthony Chavez, 30, standing in the front yard covered in blood and sweat, the report stated. John was in extreme panic and changed his statements on the events that occurred several times. Under Miranda, John asked, "I didn't kill him, did I?" the report stated. Officers found a broken golf club in the yard, and several witnesses said they saw the man in the front yard separately and together, the report stated. Chavez was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. He remained in the Ector County Jail Monday night on a $30,000 surety bond. Odessian accused of beating and robbing girlfriend. An Odessa man was arrested early Thursday morning after the mother of his child accused him of knocking out one of her teeth and pushing her out of a moving vehicle. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a robbery call from the 1900 block of North Lee Street around 1 a.m. Thursday. When officers arrived, they found a 23-year-old woman sitting on a curb with black marks up and down her clothes and a scrape on her right hip. The woman told officers Tavaron Smith, 36, picked her up from work, asked her how much money she made, and informed her everything she made was his, the report stated. She said Smith punched her in the face, knocking a tooth out. He then pushed her out of the moving vehicle before stopping, getting out, and grabbing her purse, which contained $230 of her rent money, the woman told police. Smith was arrested on suspicion of robbery. He remained in the Ector County Jail Monday night on a $25,000 surety bond and a parole violation charge. Police: package thief threatens victims with gun. An Odessa woman was arrested Friday night after her neighbors accused her of stealing a package and chasing them with a gun. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a call about a person with a gun from the High Plains Apartments on Andrews Highway around 6 p.m. When officers arrived, three people said they had surveillance footage of Tamarina Zabrilla Glayton stealing an Amazon package worth $36 from their front door. They said she then went home and returned with a 9mm handgun, the report stated. Clayton ran at all three subjects and placed all three subjects in fear for their lives as they retreated back into their residence, the report stated. According to the report, when an officer watched the footage and knocked on Clayton's door, she ran outside and began to bang on the neighbor's door. The officer reported Clayton pushed him away when he tried to handcuff her, but he was able to take her into custody. Clayton was booked into Ector County Jail on suspicion of three counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, resisting arrest, and misdemeanor theft. She remained in custody Monday night on surety bonds totaling $76,500. STEM hosts unique end-of-semester activities. Instead of ending the fall semester with final exams, STEM Academy students dove into projects. Museum Day for the middle school, and the Gatsby Speakeasy and Gala for the high school. Museum Day was a culmination of what the students have learned in all the subject areas. Middle/high school principal Cody Griffin said, the project culminating events involved more than 400 students in the middle and high school. Every single subject, English, math, science, social studies, they all have different projects throughout the semester. In this instance, the kids are displaying some of those projects for their parents to come through and see what they worked on, Griffin said. Sixth grader Curtis Shipman gave a tour of the middle school projects that lined one of the hallways. Their projects covered budgets, Christmas ornaments, a Christmas tree, mapping, creating their own countries, and weapons. The sixth graders are covering world cultures, so they look at the different areas of the world and they look at things like their government structures, their culture, their religion, Griffin said. They devised their own country, flag, currency, religion, and how many people per square mile. They also created alliances and had battles. Shipment's country didn't have a specific religion. The main food of the country Shipment and his classmates created, Wano, was peanut butter and jelly. It depicted in the flag as a purple stripe. Bess Batreal teaches 6th and 7th grade English language arts. Her 6th graders read the book Holes, and the 7th graders read the book Refugee. Batreal said the 6th graders had to put different elements into a poster. For Refugee, her 7th graders had to choose one of the three characters to focus on. They had to complete a character analysis, which included quite a bit of information. They had to write a letter as if 10 years had passed in the novel from a character's point of view, a plot diagram, the same as they did in Holes. They also had to research, because this is a historical fiction book, so they had to research either the Holocaust, the Cuban Revolution, depending on their character, also how to complete a map and their route that they would have taken in order to try and find a place of refuge. The character Isabel from Refugee was escaping from Cuba during the Cuban Revolution. She first went to the Bahamas, but they wouldn't let them in, so they ended up in Miami, where they didn't find it easy either. There were also characters from the Holocaust and the war in Syria. I have 6th and 7th grade, and so each group finished a different novel, Batreal said. She noted that this could have been a final exam using paper and pencil and letting her know what elements of the plot they understood, but the projects allowed them to collaborate. One kid might be stronger in something than another kid, but they're helping each other out. I'm always very clear that I better see everybody's participation and everybody's writing. They're learning from each other, Batreal said. With a final exam, the students get it right or wrong, and they get feedback from the teacher. But this way, they also get feedback from their peers. They're learning at the same time as also completing a finalized project, because these are all things that I've already taught. So seeing if they can actually apply it to something that we had done in the classroom, she added. Having a mixture of exams and projects seems beneficial to her. Batreal said she can quickly tell if students understand the Texas essential knowledge and skills embedded in the projects, and she can pull in other subjects like geography, world history, and science. I can cover a ton of TEXS at one time, and so it kind of helps me also to see if they understand, she added. For 9th through 12th grade, they set up a murder mystery set in the 1920s and based on Gatsby's parties that were famous in the book The Great Gatsby. The project, devised by English teacher Iva Hodges, said world history teacher Nicole Olivas, combined not only English and history, but science. They are also looking at the speakeasies from the time period, Griffin said. The speakeasy was put on by the chemistry teacher Jacob Green. There was a secret knock to get into the speakeasy. There were also wanted posters for criminals from the period. It's a collaborative effort between the English and history class. Olivas was teaching about the Roaring Twenties. I was teaching the Great Gatsby. We came together and were doing a murder mystery. They're having to solve a 1920s-based murder with evidence and support their conclusions and come up with a hypothesis, motives, those kinds of things, Hodges said. A coffee bar and photo booth were set up along with the speakeasy in the chemistry classroom. The murder mystery let the students use their skills from English, history, and science to solve the crime. Plus, they got a glimpse of how things operated in the 1920s.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.